2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 214, The Anthropic Argument, Mormon Finitism and the Argument from Design, a Re-Examination. Participants, Mark S. Gustafson and Eric K. Gustafson.
This paper will be given by Mark Gustafson, who's an attorney living in Sandy, Utah. But like most of the philosophers, theologians here at Sunstone, he's an attorney. I actually feel sort of out of place here. I teach philosophy at UVSC, and I'm here at Sunstone as a philosophy theologian too, but the rest of them are all attorneys, so I'm kind of thinking I should have got a JD. Mark received his degree in law from the University of Utah and a bachelor's degree in philosophy from there, and was telling me that he was pursuing his master's degree, and Peter Appleby said, "No, job market's so horrible now, you'd be a fool to try to get a graduate degree in philosophy, so you should go into law or something else." He's published articles widely in Dialogue and Sunstone. In fact, I remember reading a great article that he had on the problem of evil in Sunstone when I was on that mission. I know I shouldn't have been reading that, but but it was a good article, and I was worried about the problem, so it helped me. And he's actually published 3 books as well on automotive subjects. Is that right? He's married, has 3 children, and one of his children, Eric Gustafson, will be responding to him. He's a law student following in his father's footsteps at the University of Utah, and also has a bachelor's degree in philosophy, too. So,
that's the sins of the father.
Yeah, exactly. So without further ado, Mark will present his paper, Eric will respond, and then we'll have comments from the audience. Thanks.
Thanks, Dennis. In his 1974 lecture, cosmologist and astronomer Brandon Carter advised the audience at the International Astronomic Union that the list of remarkable coincidences he had assembled about nature might imply something remarkable about the universe, since they appeared, collectively, to explain not only the existence of conditions leading to the formation of warm water-covered planets, but also through the appearance of intelligent life. From Planck's constant to the exact descriptions of the weak and strong nuclear forces to the precise rate of expansion of the universe following the Big Bang, he said, the laws of nature appear to militate in favor of life. Like Aquinas, Fred Hoyle, Richard Swinburne, and others, Carter also offered that it was implausible to believe that intelligent life emerged either randomly or through the impersonal calculations of natural selection. The old argument from design has emerged again through the discoveries wrestled from nature through the efforts of some contemporary physicists. These new arguments, spearheaded by an unlikely agreement between some theologians and scientists, postulate that the designer is implied by the remarkable coincidence of factors without which no life would have been possible. In his interesting piece, Post-Agnostic Science, How Physics is Revising the Argument from Design, philosophy professor Robert C. Kuhn summarizes the well-known ratios between the 4 fundamental forces, gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear forces. For example, if the weak nuclear force was significantly stronger, fusion at the time of the Big Bang would have proceeded directly to iron, which would have meant a star-free universe. If the weak nuclear force was even marginally weaker, then a universe with only helium would have been the result. Thus, the weak nuclear force had to be extremely weak, but just strong enough to permit supernova to occur. Similarly, if the strong nuclear force were just 2% stronger, protons couldn't form. If only 1% stronger, then all the carbon in the universe would have turned into oxygen. Equivalent observations were presented about electromagnetism. If stronger, only red stars would exist, and if weaker, then only fast-burning blue dwarfs would have developed, and so forth. Professor Kuhns, who confesses that he's sympathetic to the newly emergent argument from design, opines that, and I quote, "Since life seems to depend upon the formation of stars and planetary systems, since no life could exist in the frigidity of starless deep space or within the superheated interior of stars, these processes of star formation and destruction turn out to be very sensitive to the slightest variations in the fundamental constants of the universe. Consequently, the universe is in some sense fine-tuned for the possibility of complex chemistry and thus of life." Freshly minted, the newly coined anthropic argument was no better summarized than by Patrick Glenn, who described it as suggesting, quote, that far from being some curious sideshow or accident, humanity, or life at least, appeared to be the goal to which the entire universe had been intricately orchestrated, the logical center around which a host of physical values and relationships had been exquisitely and precisely arranged. Following Carter and Glenn, physicist Paul Davies plotted in a series of books the broader questions precipitated by the anthropic argument, though, unlike those who followed, he never reached a conclusion. And physicist Frank Tipler and cosmologist John D. Barrow produced a magnum opus in which they meditated on the implications of contemporary scientific discoveries. From this foundation, many scientists, including Salisbury, Yockey, Coppedge, Bradley, and Thaxton, have observed that the high probability of the basic organization of matter, not to mention, as Sagan does, that the odds against a specific human genome being established are 1 in 10 to the billionth power, entails that some order of directing intelligence must have created or organized the universe to have yielded the results observed today. Other advocates followed in these arguments, including astronomer Fred Hoyle, who openly suggests that the model of natural evolution and the age of the planet are insufficient to explain the diversity and sophistication of life on Earth. That therefore, he says, the primordial soup was seeded by an unknown force, the focus of which effort was to produce intelligent life. As recently as 10 days ago, in a presentation at the International Society of Optical Engineering, Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe told the audience that high-altitude balloon sampling above the troposphere revealed the ubiquitous presence of bacteria and microorganisms that could not have originated on the surface. Thus, some elements of life originate in interstellar space and drop to Earth after being transported here by passing comets. This new interest in the anthropic argument might come as a mild surprise to those who still hold to the metaphysical assumptions of mainstream Christian thought, which occupies itself in large part about in what manner the existence of a supernatural God who orchestrated the universe and all life in it might be demonstrated by pure reason. The natural reaction among theists to the anthropic argument is that science has finally declared what they believed all along. Until this resurrection of the argument from design, most theists appear to have adopted Kant's exsanguinated verdict that the existence of God is beyond the grasp of reason or science. Thus, the anthropic argument, really the argument from design in a fresh suit, has appeared again as a strong echo of the writings of the angelic father St. Thomas Aquinas and those that followed him. To a modern world not suffused with the planted assumption that God exists, because logical positivism and its derivatives have produced in popular culture a kind of antiseptic atheism, it is hard to understand the historic passion to demonstrate both existence and the attributes of God. There is no St. Anselm these days to argue with a subtlety foreign to contemporary taste that the non-existence of God is inconceivable. This time decked out in the finery of one reading of modern-day scientific revelations, the anthropic argument seems to respond neatly to the cold assessments of Nietzsche, Heidegger, Sartre, and Camus, who jointly agreed with Bertrand Russell that science had rigorously shown life to be the product not of design, but of pure contingency. To them, the heliocentric revolution of Copernicus had finally reached its zenith. Not only was humanity not the central point of the physical universe, but human life was to be properly understood as, quote, a curious accident in a backwater, close quote, and not the result of the act of a creator God. Today I want to briefly analyze the argument from design and then move to look at how, if at all, the argument works in the context of LDS finitist metaphysics. We need to determine if the anthropic argument overcomes the cynical observation that it is merely a tautology, since we could not be expected to observe the fundamental characteristics of the universe that is not capable of producing intelligent life smart enough to ask these questions. Finally, if there is any strength in the anthropic argument, does it reveal the personal God of LDS theology, or an alternative, either a holy other or a malevolent demon? As we start this examination of the strength and applicability of the argument from design to LDS metaphysics, it would be best to briefly re-examine some elements of traditional Christian orthodoxy. Within the scope of classical metaphysics, the question of proving the existence of God is shifted between two center points of consideration. First, the existence of a metaphysical prime mover who animates an insensate world otherwise incapable of being reconciled to a supremely intelligent being, quote, by whom all nature's things are directed to this end, close quote. And second, if only the existence but not the characteristics of God can be proved and adequately understood through examining the artifacts of God's design, are all the time filtered through the sparkling lens of unaided human reason, what sort of God do we have? These considerations and others are based upon the generally agreed upon traditional assumption, cheerfully challenged by Mormon thought, that if God existed at all, God must be absolutely powerful and therefore able to transcend the nature which he created in an inexplicable and indescribable moment from absolute nothingness. Historically, there was no distinction between metaphysical naturalism, where life arises out of the void as naturally as the exact nature of the weak nuclear force produces the results it does, and transcendental creationism, which requires the conscious and directed activity of some force acting in light of a predetermined end. Since classical Christian theology rests upon the immanence and power of God that are absolute and therefore in principle beyond human understanding, it has been inconceivable to theists that less than such power would be sufficient to produce the results of a natural universe populated by self-aware, intelligent creatures. The greatest of the medieval clerics, Thomas Aquinas, postulated in his fifth argument that the existence of God might be shown by examining the nature of the world. His argument from design was advanced against the backdrop of classical Christian metaphysics that postulated that God was an object that infinitely transcended all sensible objects and created all things in the universe in an act of ex nihilo creation. Consequently, Aquinas pointed out, we can argue from an effect to a cause, and if the effect is of such a kind that it can proceed only from a certain kind of cause, he argued for the existence of that cause which he called God. His position was insightful and carried with it the weaknesses inherent in traditional Christian metaphysics. Despite his best efforts, when Aquinas pointed out that certain facts of the world require a logically sufficient ontological explanation, he does not escape the charge that his argument is essentially circular in nature. That his conclusion is tied up in the premises of his argument scarcely permits any other result. Though it is too simple a summation, Aquinas argued that if there was a design in the universe, by which he meant an observable order moving forward toward an objective defined by the Christian creeds, God could therefore be inferred from observing the things created and their natural progression. Because Aquinas saw things in the universe as organized toward an end, as a function of the animating influence of that thing that, quote, men call God, and were not merely organized by God with no objective, the views of our medieval friend differ from contemporary advocates of the argument, of the anthropic argument, who agitate in favor of designing influence in the appearance of intelligent life, which then proceeds to identify and follow its own objectives, entirely apart from any universe-wide teleology. It is unlikely that Aquinas, for instance, and Hoyle would have found much common ground. However, the issue is more complicated, especially when viewed from the vantage point of contemporary analysis. Though Aquinas postulated that a design implied by a designer, in the same way in his oft-quoted example that, quote, an arrow is directed by an archer, Thomistic metaphysics perennially begged the question in a way that few contemporary theists, excepting Swinburne, perhaps, would tolerate. The Thomistic proofs of the existence of God were offered against the background of an established set of metaphysical assumptions, the full extent and detail of which were premises in that proof. As Peter Appleby once succinctly observed, quote, Aquinas undertook to show how people already within the Christian fold could reconcile their faith with the insights of secular learning. His claim was one of logical compatibility, not of independent support. The reluctance of many modern philosophers and scientists to move from the general argument for a designer to the postulation of the personal God of the creeds might be a function of the care most philosophers take these days when interpreting ambiguous evidence. For instance, a persuasive argument for an ordered progression in nature and in human affairs directed by a beneficent God is certainly not made by the history of the 20th century. It's unclear, for instance, how a goal orchestrated by a God worthy of worship and in charge of things could be deduced from observing the predations of totalitarian governments in the 20th century. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here a bit. Russell's ice-cold assessment that life on Earth is a product not of design, but of pure contingency, neatly summarizes the postulation that a single configuration of reality, that is, our universe, is just one of an infinite number of possible universes, but this one with life, is sufficient to explain human life and puts to rest what he would undoubtedly characterize as an idle effort to derive metaphysical meaning out of ambiguous events. To Russell, it was a mockery to decide that God existed based on the evidence of human life, since, on the most fundamental level, Aquinas' designer only fashioned the universe to be generous to life in general, but indifferent, if not infrequently hostile, to individual instantiations of life. After all, Russell and others argued, if the things can occur in their own, where's the need for the consideration of a designer? If there is no archer needed, for instance, if arrows naturally fly around in all directions. Of course, that view is not now universally shared among the scientific community, though the physicist Richard Carrier does a decent job of dissembling the modernistic incarnation of the argument from design, anthropic coincidence occupied the attention of a diverse group of philosophers and scientists, including those like Swinburne, who argued that the initial conditions of life and the basic physics which preceded those conditions were fine-tuned for intelligent life. The question of whether matter is arranged for the purpose of precipitating life from the primordial soup of the universe involves more than just an appreciation of the perspective presented by shifting paradigms. Rather, the ways in which equivocal evidence is interpreted is also at issue. For instance, the assumption that a grand unifying theory exists to tie together the strands of the universe in chaos on a quantum level would be, if true, a unifying force in the universe about which Aquinas could not have dreamed. Yet, in spite of tantalizing suggestions that something is in fact tying the universe together, the only reason to label that theory God is to adopt classical metaphysics, Christian metaphysics, wholesale. What would the force or thing be like that could order and design the characteristics and operational implications of the weak nuclear force? Can God be found in exporting the details of and implications of string theory to theology? Actually, the reluctance, if not the refusal, to make religion out of observational datum about the universe suggests not an a priori refusal to imply God from nature, but only that we expect more from our arguments these days than might have satisfied Aquinas. The anthropic argument postulates that the sort of God that could not just provide for the ubiquity of carbon in the universe, but also establish the exact level of strength of the strong nuclear force, at least as we measure it, is not a description that fits any recognizable parameters. That is, the argument from design, whether based on classical Christian formulations or resting on contemporary scientific observations, must do more than suggest the inference that some kind of unifying force exists that designed nature right down to the tiniest conceivable subatomic particle or force. For the argument from design to work, there must be some reasonably plausible link between the creator and what is created. After all, the connection must be made between the creative force and everyday human life to justify and make reasonable human interest. Classical Christian metaphysics do little to aid in this investigation. There is a profound tension between the biblical claims about the personality of God and the kind of utterly incomprehensible being capable of literally creating the rules and stuff of nature from the singularity that is alleged to have existed in that moment, if that's what we call it, before the Big Bang. Whether or not an accurate description of the universe, classical Christian metaphysics are not materially different from the power entailed by the physicist's view of the universe. The putative ability to literally make something from nothing requires a power divorced in principle from human experience. If the universe was spawned in an unfathomably blinding moment of heat and light, as some scientists postulate, there is only room in that creation scenario for an utterly alien God whose purposes cannot plausibly be said to concern the lives of individual human beings. Such an entity could only exist if devoid of any characteristics that would make that force relevant to the objectively mundane but subjectively critical experiences of ordinary men and women. Said another way, the more powerful the God, as defined by the assigned level of authority in designing and then creating the universe, the less relevant that entity is. Therefore, it's a puzzle why mainstream Christian and a few LDS theologians rush, often uncritically, to embrace this new argument from design. Moreover, there are strong moral reasons to reject the anthropic argument. To the extent that the creative force postulated by the argument could have made reality one way and not another, and such power inheres in this conception of God, then it is not impertinent to ask why things turned out as they did. Since a malevolent entity could desire intelligent life in the universe no less than a benevolent spirit, the mere existence of an organizing force in the universe does not entail the uncompromised geniality of such a deity. That is, an evil demon that creates the universe would fashion intelligent life in order to play out its cruel intentions in a way best calculated to make matters as bad as they could be. Effort like Swinburne's and those of some LDS writers to accommodate and explain moral and natural evil in the world on the grounds of their soul-making properties, or because those evils are necessary to allow human beings the opportunity to eradicate, respectively, pillaging and childhood leukemia, reveal the ambiguity and undeveloped moral sentiments many suffer when trying to reconcile evil with a God who could have arranged the fabric of nature to have prevented typhoons from sweeping, swaddling Bangladesh infants into the Bay of Bengal. Therefore, mere power is not coextensive with goodness. There's another interesting point here, too. The kind of power suggested by the modern argument from design implies some interesting things about God apart from the relevance of such a force to human life. If there is an omnipotent God who created the world ex nihilo, for instance, can everything in that world be logically and necessarily linked to God's creative act? A.J. Ayer's assessment that there is no proof for a designer might be a function of a particular description of the nature of God. That is, what would count as proof of that sort of a designer? How could anyone distinguish between the created thing and the creator of those things? It appears that God could only be individuated by drawing an arbitrary line between the designer and the things designed. And what kind of God is then implied? There's another problem, too. There must be some distinction drawn between what might be reasonably supposed as a blind rule of nature and the kind of ordered progression that appears to have underpinned Aquinas' logical structure. It's unclear, for instance, whether Aquinas would have been as anxious to advance his fifth argument if he did not believe that there was sufficient evidence to suggest that things in the universe were moving toward a specific end. We are left to wonder what his argument might have looked like if he didn't discern an order in nature, or if that end was that he observed was malevolent. With those musings in mind, before we look at what LDS theology might have to say about the question of proof for God based on naturalistic observations, a few more preliminary comments are in order. A fresh look at the question may be provided by some elements of Mormon finitism that are commonly, but prematurely, seen as a way to ease the inquiry into the proof for God. Mormon metaphysics sets out an interesting perspective that illuminates the effort to prove the nature of God within this religious tradition. Traditional Mormon metaphysics declares that that nature operates according to self-existent laws, some of which are not the result of the conscious organizational act of God. As the King Follett sermon asserts, God ascended to his position through obedience to law, suggesting, without recourse to an endless reducto ad absurdum, that the universe and the laws that govern much of it are uncreated and eternal. As Joseph Smith advised, the Mormon God doesn't create, but rather organizes. The importance of this perspective can scarcely be underestimated. If nature, like each individual soul, is uncreated, then the universe is defined and characterized by the laws of nature. Consequently, the existence of matter and the rules that govern it were not fashioned from nothing, at least not by any superior creature of any concern to humanity who had initial and ultimate authority over the existence of moral and natural evil. But what is this? What does Mormon metaphysics say about the argument from design? With this background, here only briefly explored in mind, the argument from design appears initially to find a hospitable place in Mormon theology, if on a level different than would satisfy Aquinas. After all, we might argue, if God organizes stuff instead of creating it, we should be able to learn everything important about God by looking at the things in the world. In the same way that some might argue that we could learn something about Frank Lloyd Wright by looking at falling water at Bear Run, or the Johnson Wax Building. Similarly, some claim a flower or one of those marvelous nebulae revealed by the orbiting Hubble telescope say something about God's interest in beautiful things. Note that Wright's architectural design was not parasitic on his power to establish the physics of metallurgy, any more than the ability to organize a gaseous nebula depends upon creating, ex nihilo, Planck's constant. LDS theology changes the entire complexion of the argument from design by denying the omnipotence of God. The importance of this observation is subtle but essential. If God is not the author of reality, then the argument does not have to deliver as much as it must within the context of classical Christian metaphysics. Namely, if the characteristics of God are to be understood in direct rather than in analogical terms, then different results obtain from the argument. For existence, if God were said to love or experience delight or anger or appreciate beauty, human beings might understand those emotions in ways substantially equivalent to the way in which human beings comprehend those terms. With that in mind, it seems clear that discerning some attributes of God from the natural world are easier because whatever is claimed to reflect the design existence or attributes can be understood in terms that do not require setting the ground rules of existence itself. But what then of the anthropic argument in the LDS setting? Initially, the argument from design must demonstrate the God of Mormon metaphysics exists unequivocally. That's a difficult task since the deity in finitist theology does not have the limited power entailed by classical Christian belief. Therefore, an ontological argument of the sort that Anselm would want to advance is not available in this finitist Christian tradition. As such, then, the argument from design in LDS theology must demonstrate that things in the universe are amended by a kindly but less than all-powerful entity toward a specific objective, not from the form of the argument itself. It will not be enough to suggest that God exists for the reason that an argument based on the structure and beauty of nature requires it, for the reason that an Anselmian class a priori argument does as much. Next, the argument from design must demonstrate in the LDS context that God possesses characteristics that can be directly and not analogically understood by human beings, and that God is morally good. This too is an interesting task, since it's hard to imagine what sort of things observable in nature would demonstrate the existence of a morally good God who struggles with implacable evil and choice in the finitist setting required, as I see it, by Mormon theology. For instance, what do we learn about God by observing the Crab Nebula or understanding the morphology of human pathogens? The objective here is to demonstrate that God is directly and personally invested and interested in individual human beings, to avoid postulating the God of Aristotle that could not by definition be understood in the tangible sense required by Mormon metaphysics. The argument of design must also tell us more than just some sort of God exists. It must also tell us something about what action God takes if we decide that God does act in response to the conditions exterior to that deity. The matter of coming to an understanding of God's attributes and nature is a separate inquiry from deciding, if we can, that God exists at all. And here the matter gets considerably more difficult. It is not clear that an anthropomorphic God is revealed by examining the petals of a daisy or observing the majesty of a Columbian ice field. What attribute or characteristic of God, anthropomorphic or otherwise, relevant to the life of the individual believer is revealed by studying quantum physics or botany? To avoid a tautology, the argument from design must deliver a comprehensive picture of the character and nature of God that is distinctly LDS. I suspect the argument cannot deliver as much. But interestingly, there's another avenue that is available to the Mormon theists concerning the anthropic argument, and we'll explore that shortly. Finally, the argument from design in LDS theology must be more than tautologically true. Even if you buy the argument that there are necessary truths which are not mere tautologies, we must insist, especially in the Mormon context, that claims about God's existence and attributes are firmly tied to tangible evidence. Propositional statements about God in Mormonism, especially when linked to the question of the argument from design, must satisfy a test of meaningfulness which is principally characterized by the understanding that it must be metaphysically and logically possible for God and humanity not to exist. That is, God's existence and characteristics have to be contingently demonstrated, since an argument demonstrating the existence of God by logical entailment is not different from the scholastic disposition to fashion God's proofs of God in reliance upon Platonic metaphysics. Regardless, the problem with even this LDS morphed anthropic argument is that it neither proves the existence of God nor tells us anything at all about those attributes of God that would be of much interest to individual human beings. To decide what kind of home the argument finds in LDS theology, there are several additional tests that must be satisfied. Unless these requirements are met, the argument of design is little more than a marginally interesting artifact of the scholastic period, no matter how well polished by modern physics. These inquiries and observations suggest that the argument of design doesn't work any better in Mormonism than it does in traditional Christianity. First, the cosmological argument can be defeated by the interior observation that any assembly of evidence for the existence of God, derived from noting the nature of the universe, are always a posteriori. It does no good, for instance, to speculate about what the chances are for life to exist at all, since life exists. Obviously, the conditions preceding to life are satisfied earlier than the time that there are those who wonder about such questions. Similarly, many questions are begged by the observation that the argument design proves that God exists only because such an inquiry exists once there is life to consider the question. The test of meaningfulness is satisfied only if we move past the point of knowing that if there were no life, there would be no one to make the argument that God exists. Though some, like Glynn and Swinburne, dismiss this critique of the anthropic argument as mere cynicism, their rejection leads to little more than an embrace of the God of classical Christian dimension, which is both irrelevant to human experience and unworthy of human adoration for that reason. Second, it's not clear that we can avoid a kind of crude pantheism entailed by the argument that a sufficiently comprehensive study of nature will demonstrate that God exists. The argument from design must preserve the distinction between an individual personal God and the Gaian hypothesis in which sufficient power to explain nature inheres in nature itself. In the LDS context, is the argument design any more than a tautology, since it presupposes that there's a God? After all, postulating about a divine attribute is something apart from showing that there is a God about which such postulation might occur. Third, we must draw the difficult distinction between the question of whether God exists and the question about determining which attributes authentically describe God. This point is made clear by understanding that the only coherent response to the question, do you believe that God exists, is, well, what kind of God do you have in mind? For instance, we might decide that the God of Aquinas exists by reviewing the unfolding universe revealed through the lens of traditional Christian metaphysics. But that effort is distinct, though not in any hard sense, from asking about what attributes of such a deity might be. We need to agree upon some minimalist description of God to determine what standards of proof would count as demonstrating that entity's existence. In the final analysis, the arguments from design, regardless of their vintage, are not a useful tool to prove the existence or attributes of God. The argument does not, because it cannot, satisfy the test of meaningfulness, because anything it tells you about God would be available by argument in many configurations of the argument from design. Because of the way in which the argument is constructed, any idea of God produced by the argument is entailed by the nature of the argument and is therefore ubiquitous and not specific to any religious tradition. And in no Christian tradition does the argument tell us about those attributes of God, whether analogically or directly described, that are relevant to the life of the individual believer. To be important to the faithful, the argument must tell us something about God's characteristics that affect the everyday life of the believer. It seems that the argument from design may deliver some understanding of the God of the physicists, but little else. Though the argument from design, a complete picture of God, is not produced by an exhaustive study of botany, physics, astronomy, biology, or other disciplines, any more than one would come to know the moral values and character of Augie Duesenberg by studying one of the wired wheels of his magnificent automobiles. Regardless of the configuration of the argument, things are just artifacts that not reveal any more than a tiny view of the artisan. This problem is nettlesome in the Mormon context because nature is considered to be co-eternal with God. It is hard to imagine what kind of argument in the LDS setting would conclusively lead the skeptic to concede that God exists, while at the same time adequately describing the characteristics of God relevant to the life of the believer, and both goals must be met concurrently. In the end, I suspect that the unique finitist aspects of Mormon theology provide some hint at the resolution of this question. Mormon finitism cheerfully celebrates the corporeality of God and the strong identity between the purposes of God and the interests of humanity. As I've shown previously, there is much strength in the metaphor of marooning, where humanity is seen as stranded in this veil of tears, aided by a personal God who weeps with their losses, who celebrates our successes, and who sits in the tent of the dispossessed as their agonized wailing reaches up to heaven. Slugging through the same ugly conditions of reality with humanity in the hope of creating eternal home where we may all one day rest, God becomes a partner in the process and a wise and knowing friend, more interested in kind wisdom than in power and obedience. That view of God, available only through direct experience with Him and one another, offers a glimpse of God that is understandable and fulfills our requirements of moral goodness. With that in mind, perhaps only personal interplay with God, which includes direct, tangible interaction, but which does not exclude revelatory experience, will satisfy the inquisitive mind. The Old Testament and Joseph Smith models of direct experience with deity have a lot of appeal and appear to be the best avenue available in the Mormon tradition to prove and enjoy the existence of God. Thank you. Let me say one thing. This is the difference between his generation and mine. I write it down, he reads it from his computer.
My printer was characteristically broken, so... The argument from design was misguided at its inception and remains misguided today, whether enshrined by the scientific analysis of the anthropic argument or in the more abstract configuration imagined by the medievals. The position fails both procedurally and in application, as it makes the mistake of starting with a conclusion and vainly attempting to work toward a proof, while simultaneously creating a model of God, which is both incomplete and insulting to those who believe God to be a benevolent creature disposed toward the welfare and progress of humans. My response to Mark's paper will be in two parts. First, I'd like to point out a number of areas in which I agree with his analysis and conclusion, shockingly, and then proceed to illustrate an error in his position that I believe is born of his desire to uphold the uniquely Mormon concept of God, perhaps at the cost of some level of intellectual honesty. Oh, sorry. Okay. Is that better?
No.
Is that better?
I'd recommend that you actually
take it
out
and speak. Okay. I'm about to check. Is that better? Okay. All right. I'd like to discuss four ways in which the anthropic argument or the argument from design fails: as insulting on moral grounds, as incompatible with the Mormon concept of deity, on grounds of relevance to human life, and as flawed in its logical structure. Initially, on a moral analysis, a close review of the argument from design raises serious concerns that are not illuminated by the cursory reflection more frequently given to the position. The argument from design generally presumes that since the world is so complex and so beautiful, or since the chances for the emergence of life are so narrow, that the only possible explanation must be the existence of a creator who worked some kind of a mystical miracle that resulted in order from disorder and life from disarray. However, those who make this argument tend to employ a one-way lens when presenting their argument, looking only to those things in the world that are bright and cheery when arguing for the existence of their God. Left behind are the vast array of events and conditions in human existence that are truly miserable and seem calculated against the interest of humans, not for them. For instance, though the beauty of nature can well be all awe-inspiring, ignored for some reason are things such as bubonic plague, natural disasters of level civilizations, harsh weather conditions that contribute to horrific child mortality rates, and other similarly awful factors which seem intent, if not on eliminating human life, on making it as difficult and unpleasant as possible. If we look only to puppy dogs and ice cream, the argument from design finds shallow purchase, but a more comprehensive survey of human life suggests that if human existence is the function of the creative or directive power of a deity, that deity is at best ambivalent to human happiness, and at worst is intent on ensuring the ongoing proliferation of human suffering, instantiated each time a volcano destroys a village, consuming believers, non-believers, adults, and infants alike. This suggests to me, at least, that the anthropic argument is irreconcilable with the Mormon concept of deity. If the Mormon God wants us to learn, grow, and progress, and if our nature and the conditions of this world are a product of his divine arrangement, then how do we account for the impersonal destructive power of Mother Nature, or the terror experienced by millions in the last 100 years at the altar of the regimes of Stalin, Pol Pot, and others? The Mormon God, I believe, of Third Nephi would agonize when a mutating strain of tuberculosis kills 1,000 third world infants, or when a mad dictator exacts the death of millions in the service of a misguided epic. It would make no sense to say, then, that the Mormon God is simultaneously both troubled by human suffering and is the author of human misery. Given this, I'd suggest that a faithful and reflective Mormon could not accept an argument from design, given that the entity revealed by the position is not the God of Mormonism. Next, even if we were to assume arguendo that the anthropic argument did prove the existence of God, the creature we found will have purposes so foreign to the interest of humans that we should either ignore the entity we've created or fear it. Any being responsible for the creation of the horrific elements of human life, when they could have made them different, deserves none of our respect. To say of a God that he made the world in a way that allows nature to destroy and individual humans to decimate, when she could have done otherwise, is to argue not for the existence of a God, but instead of the existence of a devil. This reveals to us, I think, a more subtle flaw with the argument, and that is that, namely, all those who argue for it start with the conclusion that God exists and appoint themselves as missionaries to somehow cobble up an argument that reifies their assumption, rather than starting with the evidence before them and then asking if what they see allows them to suggest the existence of a God. Most proponents of the argument from design are so invested in their presumption that God exists that any argument, no matter how strained, functions to them as conclusive proof of something they think they already know. Finally, I'd like to reject the more scientific suggestion that the improbability of life somehow proves the existence of a God. In essence, this position would hold that since the conditions required for life are so unusual, and that since if any of an innumerable number of variables were off to any degree that life, or at least life as we know it, would not have occurred, that the only possible accounting must be the existence of a supreme being who made sure that all the necessary conditions obtained. Unfortunately, this line of argumentation leaves us with nothing, as the fact that life is improbable is not coextensive with the conclusion that life is impossible without the intervening act of a supreme being. As long as we're willing to concede that life could have obtained short the participation of some sort of external force, then improbability cannot be confused with impossibility. In short, that it is unlikely that life exists does not reveal the necessity of an entity that made sure that it did. Now, it's my belief that Mark would not disagree with anything I've said to this point, although if experience has shown me anything, it's that I'm probably wrong. I think he's right to dismiss the argument from design, both on face and for the unsatisfactory moral conception of God that it produces. I'd like, though, to move on to a few comments on how I think Mark's analysis, while yielding the proper conclusion, spends too much time bogged down in arguing for an admittedly unique Mormon vision of God. In essence, it seems that Mark believes that because the argument from design fails to reveal the characteristics of God, or more importantly, the characteristics of the Mormon God, that the argument is not useful. I am, as I've argued above, sympathetic to his position, but I do not think that the argument fails for the reason that it does not find a God of Mormonism. It is conceivable that the argument does reveal to us the presence of an organizing or creative entity, albeit one whose interests are either foreign to us or perhaps even designed to compromise ours. However, that the God we find is not the God we want doesn't mean he doesn't exist, and I think that's where Mark makes his mistake. Mark is understandably committed to defending the Mormon incarnation of deity, but this dedication may hinder a more objective analysis.
That is, the failure of the anthropic argument does not hinge on whether it reveals the God of Mormonism, or the God of traditional Christianity, or the God of a fundamentalist sect nestled in Montana. The argument from design must be rejected on grounds other than that it doesn't reinforce one's particular vision of what we mean when we use the term God. My concern is that, as the medievals might have started with the conclusion that God exists and worked backward toward a proof of such, Mark may well be presuming that if the argument from design fails to produce the Mormon God, it fails to produce any God at all. At bottom, such an approach cannot be acceptable, as it would be disingenuous to assume that an argument which leads us somewhere uncomfortable does not lead us anywhere at all.
He made two mistakes in his life. First, he went to study philosophy, and second, went to law school. I'm not sure which is worse.
We have 15 minutes for questions. Since we have a significant amount of time, why don't I have you come up and ask the question in the microphone so that it's on the tape? And I also wanted to remind everyone that this session is sponsored by Element, an e-journal of philosophy and theology, which can be found on the internet at element-mormon.org. So if you're interested in, there's articles in there. Actually, no articles on the cosmological argument, but on things like the problem of evil and so forth, which have been addressed. I'm sorry, it's element-mormon.org. Yes?
Will these papers and response be available there?
Not on that journal. Maybe if Mark wants to submit it and it's peer-reviewed, and then it's a peer-reviewed journal, so blind-reviewed journal. So, we will have a new issue of the journal coming out. There's one issue out right now. It's an annual, and there will be a new issue of the journal coming out near the end of the year, probably November, on alternative approaches to theology, non-mainstream approaches to theology. We're going to have articles by process, from a process perspective, from an existentialist perspective, and some other perspectives as well. Go to the internet and check out the journal.
Yes, I have two comments. And one is, I've always, in my review of the anthropic argument, it seems to me that it misapplies the laws of statistics, because they simply can't be applied to one-time occurrences. Whether it's Boolean statistical analysis or other types of regular statistical analysis, I don't see that any statistical analysis can even apply to such events. It seems to me that the argument can't even begin to get off the ground. But I want to ask a question about something that I think is logically prior to the argument, but based and relevant to what you've said. And that is, how could a being that is located within a space-time universe, who is material, as you say, and I'm assuming there's some continuity of the word matter with what we know, if all matter, space, time, and so forth begin at the singularity of the Big Bang, A, how could such a being be eternal, as the Mormon scriptures are wont to say? How could there be a beginningless intelligence or something if it is of the same order? I assume that it is, because on such a view, everything is material. And how could it possibly be, for instance, that God could organize, especially given that once we start with the initial constants in the Big Bang, it seems that the order falls out from those constants, which aren't created by God, and therefore even a God who organizes and orders becomes superfluous. That's my question.
Blake makes an interesting question about how a God whose existence is subordinate to the Big Bang could survive the next collapse. Physicists have talked about that. I suppose there are two responses. First of all, the Big Bang isn't true. That something like Hoyle's cosmological constant is more likely to be the truth. And as I read the physics journals these days, that question is open. Or that there is something remarkable, we're into speculation here of the grandest kind, but there is some remarkable condition or aspect of not only that deity, but those gathered with them, which would survive the next collapse. I don't know how to answer these things, of course, but it occurs to me that because of the unlikelihood of an organizing. The next collapse, or originating at any time X after the Big Bang, does not entail logically or factually that there is the God of Aristotle who sits on a crystalline sphere outside of existence and looks in. That is, we are still faced with the obligation of making sense, of reconciling what a God relevant to our concern would be with the universe as we see it. And I don't know that there's an easy answer to that. What I am unhappy with and uncomfortable with is the notion that God has the kind of power necessary to not only organize matter, but to set its terms and conditions, and then trying to understand that power in the context of a world which might be different than it is.
Well, I wanted to say I'm not particularly troubled by the question of if we had a Big Bang, doesn't that mean that everything just fell into place and God doesn't really have any organizing power? Because I think that all the time, I mean, just as humans, we mess about with stuff genetically and in other events. And so to me, it's not much of a stretch to believe that someone vastly more intelligent could have a strong influence as far as an organizing, not a creative, certainly, within Mormon context, but as far as an organizing power. I don't think that's much of a stretch. I could be wrong, of course.
It would have to be more than vocally physically present. I mean, even, over the galaxy.
I mean, let's assume what I think is quite unlikely given the view given Mormon scripture, that God is just over this present galaxy. It would then take on the order of thousands upon thousands of years just for God to give, information from one side of the galaxy to the other. And if that's the case, how does any locally corporate being, as you want to say, organize anything on their level? It seems to me, frankly, Alan Guth has talked about creating, a black hole within a laboratory. And we may be able to do it within a decade. I mean, if so, we could actually create a pocket universe. But what we can't do is exist within the universe. What we can't do, it seems to me, is to have a locally corporeal being who actually is organizational on anything like the level that is contemplated in the scriptures. And if you're going to give up the scriptural notions, it seems to me that the kind of concerns that Mark has about reconciling the God of scripture, in the Old Testament even, with what we know about the universe, let's get serious. If he's going to even be within our local solar system, it doesn't make any sense to pray to God when you're 3 minutes away from a car accident, because it takes 9 minutes for God to get any information around. So it seems to me that we have a very pitiable, weak God who may as well just be a very bright and good human being like Mother Teresa.
Blake and I have debated this question for about as long as Blake and I have known each other. I think the question of God's power is not decided on the unlikelihood of God's ability to respond in real time to any particular petition we have. First, another comment is that I am unwilling, I think Blake's more willing than I am, to assume that God is limited in his organizational, in his Mormon corporeality organizational status, to our present understanding of the laws of physics. Any sufficiently advanced technology, as Clark advises, this appears as magic. And I think that the mastery of laws that we certainly don't understand now might reconcile this whole issue. Now, of course, that is the most idle kind of speculation, because the very existence of such a power would be beyond our experience, and therefore it is mere speculation and nothing more. But I think that preferring a God of power to a God of goodness, on the grounds that a God of goodness must be less powerful and less efficacious than one who could organize a local unit of a galaxy or even galaxies, qua other galaxies, is not to decide the question on proper grounds. regardless of the level of power that any deity has, that deity has a duty to justify his or her conduct with respect to each one of us. It is not enough to say, well, because God can't hear your prayers, God therefore must have the power to make all of this sensible, and questions about the morality of God and the conditions of human life are therefore impertinent. I think this question of theodicy, as Blake and I have talked about it for many years, is probably the most troubling one in all of theology. And I don't have any certainly no good answers. Mere speculation. Anyone else?
I was going to wait to see if anyone else had a question, because it seems weird for the chair to ask a question, but this is an issue that I'm interested in, being a philosopher. And I think I'm going to take the stance, although this is not necessarily my real stance, but I'm going to take the stance of defending the anthropic argument, since everyone disagrees with it here so far. First, I think... Let me grab... I think that both Mark and Eric gave a version of the anthropic argument, which is to some extent a straw man. The way in which it's a straw man is they presented the argument as if it's supposed to be a deductive argument that definitively establishes its conclusion. Not only that, but the conclusion has a modal element of necessity, that it must be that God exists. It's an epistemic modal element, I suppose, because it's sort of, given all the evidence, we must conclude that God exists, and that's what makes it seem like a deductive argument. But when it's presented by people like Richard Swinburne and others who are making this argument in contemporary, I'm thinking also of Derek Parfit, who's actually an atheist, but presents the argument in a very good way in his essay, Why Anything, I think is what it's called. When the argument's presented there, it's presented as a probabilistic argument, as Blake was referring to, or an argument from best explanation, and not as a deductive argument. It is certainly the case, and this is certainly the case, that if it is a deductive argument, then it's bad, because it doesn't follow from the fact that it would be really, really, really unlikely for there to be life unless there was a designer, that there must be a designer. It just, that doesn't follow. But it could be the case that if we suppose the hypothesis that there is a designer, then we have less to explain about the fact that life does exist, given that the conditions for life are so unlikely. And this is the kind of thing that Swinburne and actually Parfit, who is an atheist and apparently isn't convinced by the argument, but both of them push this and say this is why the argument is a good one, is because we have less to explain if we suppose the hypothesis that there is a designer, because if there is a designer, then life would be more probable. It wouldn't necessarily follow that life has to occur, but life would be more probable because designers might want to conclude, or they might want to reproduce things that are very similar to themselves or whatever. Another criticism that I have of their arguments is that it seems to me that when the anthropic argument is made by people like Swinburne and others, they do not try to conclude all of the properties of God merely from the design argument. All they want to do with the design argument is show that we have some reason to believe that there's something personal designing. And then they use other arguments, and Swinburne believes that you have to have the strength of a lot of different arguments all put together in order to get the conclusion that the Christian God exists. And he goes through quite a bit and talks about religious experience, talks about the existence of miracles and the evidence for those miracles, like resurrection and so forth. I think he would argue, in particular, that the design argument only shows that we have some reason to believe that there's a designer. There's something there, and we get the properties of it. The designer even might be malevolent. We don't know. But we get the other properties from this of this designer on the basis or on the strength of other arguments, like the miracle argument or the argument from religious experience, in which we experience the designer as benevolent or as good and as powerful and as able to transcend the laws of the laws that we understand, maybe not the real true natural laws, but the laws that we understand. Anyway, so those are my two criticisms. I'm sorry, there's a long.
Thanks, Dennis. Two quick responses. I agree that Swinburne doesn't make a deductive argument, but to make out an inferential argument on the grounds based on an assumption where the first premise is that it is more likely than not that some deity exists is, of course, not only begging the question, but renders
self. That's not the premise. That's not the premise. That's the hypothesis. Let me explain more clearly,
because I think you misunderstood what I said. Here's how the argument goes, then. It's an argument from best explanation. And in an argument from best explanation, you've got a hypothesis, and from that hypothesis, something deductively follows. Okay, and you notice that thing actually occurs, that this thing follows, and so then you conclude that, okay, maybe my hypothesis is correct then. Now, that is not a deductive argument, because that's actually affirming the consequent, right? It would be a deductive fallacy. So the idea here is that supposing that there is something like a God, we would, if there were a God, then it would be more likely that life would occur, right? Life does occur, so we have some reason to believe that there's a God. It's not supposing that there is a God. What it's supposing is a hypothetical statement. If there were a God, then life would be more likely to occur than if there weren't a God. Life does occur, and so a better explanation of the fact that life occurs is that there's a God than that there's not.
I appreciate that, Dennis. I still think there's a serious and persistent problem with it. If one hypothesizes any particular propositional statement, it is human nature, in my observation, and certainly Kuhn talks about it, that you end up morphing what you decide as evidence to fit the hypothesis. It is very hard to step outside where you expect the argument to go from where you hypothesize you'll end up. And I think that's a serious problem that Swinburne, and to an even greater extent Aquinas, have first reaction. Second reaction is that it was not my view that we can decide the anthropic argument is false because it does not reveal the personal attributes of God. In fact, within traditional Christianity, you can't decide on any personal attributes of God because, as the medievals advise us, God is wholly other and that we are mere creatures of his creation. Rather, when I spoke of attributes, I spoke about them in the way required, I think, and entailed by Mormon theology, which does in fact speak of a God of body parts and passions, which in an evidentiary sense opens up the entire question about just what body parts and passions are we talking about. Therefore, within LDS theology, you cannot escape asking what the anthropic argument has to say, if it says anything at all, about what God must be like on a personal level. Therefore, I think your first point is well taken, and I disagree with your second one.
Well, my only comment would be, as far as it being an argument from best explanation, I think that it sounds like that would mean that it's part of, and you speak of this larger context of arguments into which it fits, and we assemble all of these arguments and combine those kind of push toward our conclusion. But I think that even if it's a component in a larger argument that has multiple parts, I think it's a weak one, because as long as we're willing to concede that it's possible for there not to have been a specific designer, then I don't think it matters that it helps the argument if there was a designer. I mean, I don't think it counts as evidence of anything. Maybe it bolsters some sort of broad range of arguments which kind of tend toward a conclusion, but if it's not, I don't know, if it's not demonstrative, I'm not really interested in it, and that's why I think it fails.
Just a quick response. If that is the case, what both of you say, actually, although they're different points, if that's the case, then scientific reasoning is gone. We might as well not even do science, because scientific reasoning relies on making hypotheses and seeing what's going to follow from them, and then looking at the world, seeing if that does follow, and then inferring that there's something right with the hypothesis. And if you're only going to allow demonstration, absolute deductive demonstration, then you've just abandoned science entirely. I'll let them respond, and then that'll be it, because we're done with this. I should let them have the last word.
Just one quick response. You're right. Regular scientific inquiry is in a lot of trouble, but I think the higher criticism of scientific inquiry, which came to me, I think, precipitated, talks about being modest about how we interpret and count evidence. It is very hard, for instance, to think, and because I don't think it can be plausibly argued, that any scientist, regardless of his or her background, genuinely approaches any inquiry from an objectively from an objective standpoint. I don't even know what that looks like. What is an objective standpoint, for instance, when you're talking about string theory? Because the very nature of some aspects of physics require the participation and the influence of the person observing the sense datum. So while the scientific hypothesis and the process, of course, is enormously useful and has led to a world of considerable comfort for some but not all of us, it is nevertheless true that I think we have to be careful about our assumptions about how that hypothesis to inference process works. It is not as easy as simply saying, well, if you criticize the process by observing that the biases of the participant influence the outcome, that somehow that impugns the process. I don't think there's anything to say. I think rather it simply says that we have to be more modest than I think we have in the past about just what results are genuinely precipitated by the scientific by scientific examination. Thanks, Dennis. I appreciate your comment.
No, we should continue this discussion.